This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Tonight, on a special edition of Unsolved Mysteries, at a truck stop in Oklahoma, two hitchhikers, unnerved by a man with whom they were traveling, tried to report his strange behavior. A few days later, authorities discovered that the man's pickup truck was a stolen vehicle. The hitchhikers had unknowingly grabbed a ride with a murder suspect. In Naperville, Illinois, a 10-year-old girl was abducted from her home and later brutally murdered. Two men were convicted of the crime, and one of them, Rolando Cruz, is scheduled to be executed on March 22nd. But in this most controversial case, another man has confessed that he alone killed the girl, and some of the evidence supports his claim. In Canada, they are known as the Lost Generation. Thousands of Native American children ripped away from their families and their ancestral homes to be put up for adoption. Tonight, you may be able to help two families end years of painful, forced separation. Join me for another edition of Unsolved Mysteries. February 25th, 1983.
What do you think? You think that'll match?
In Naperville, Illinois, a Chicago suburb, Chris Nicarico and her friends came home from school to a nightmarish discovery.
Oh my God, you guys!
Someone had broken into the house, and her little sister Janine was missing.
So they went around the house and they looked.
The police were called immediately.
What do we got, guys?
They found that the front door had been knocked in. A visible footprint remained on the door, and two more prints were found in the yard. A sheet and a blanket were missing from one of the beds.
It appeared to me, and I'm sure a couple other guys too, it was like it was a burglary maybe that went bad. She wasn't supposed to be home. Somebody kicks in the door, next thing you know, she's home, and they take her.
2 days later, the young girl's body was discovered in the Illinois Prairie Path, a park less than 2 miles from her home. 10-year-old Janine Nicarico had been brutally raped and beaten to death. Today, two men are in prison for the murder of Janine Nicarico, one facing execution next March 22nd. Both claim they are innocent, but there's a third man who says he is the killer and that he acted alone. The prosecutors call him a liar. But so far, three high-level law enforcement officials have quit their jobs to protest the handling of the case. They believe that the man currently scheduled to die in 5 weeks is innocent. In early 1983, an offer of a $10,000 reward led investigators to a man named Alex Hernandez. Hernandez had a reputation for trying to impress people and told police he'd been driving around drinking with several men who had talked about a murder.
Who was doing the talking, Alex? That's what we know.
Well, Rick was talking to the guys. They were passing like a bottle around.
Okay.
And he was talking to him, and he said something about
some girl. You got a last name, Alex?
No, I don't know his last name.
Hernandez had an IQ of 76 and was known around his neighborhood as Crazy Alex. His criminal record listed only one previous arrest for misdemeanor theft.
And he was crying. I seen him crying.
Hernandez named names, but only one provided a possible link to the murder. Steve Buckley owned a pair of boots that closely approximated the boot print found on the front door of the Nicarico home. Buckley became a suspect, and police began to think Alex Hernandez knew more than he was telling.
You know, somebody who told us about sitting in a car. We figured maybe now he's just trying to shift the guilt away from other, you know, from himself, and maybe he's involved. So he was a prime suspect. So to see what we could find out, we arranged for him to sit down with a person that he would know of, who was a burglar out of Aurora.
Police put Hernandez in a room with a man he knew from his neighborhood, nicknamed Pinguino.
Alex, you know, what's up, man?
How you doing? What you doing in here?
He's helping us out.
Pinguino was told to pretend he knew who had murdered another child. Police got Hernandez to cooperate by telling him he was a junior deputy and would get $10,000 in reward money if he convinced Pinguino to talk.
Right, just put it up between you, or you can take it home. I don't care. Somebody come up with something today.
A detective listened in the hallway outside.
We figured that would be a perfect way, if he knew anything. Hopefully, all it was is to get out some information that he was holding back. Hopefully, he would talk easier to his peer, somebody that he knew.
The meeting, conducted partly in Spanish, turned into a boasting contest. Pinguino claimed he knew about the murder of a young boy. Hernandez claimed he knew about the Nicarico murder. Hernandez even bragged he could show police the crime scene. He said, "I was there. I didn't kill her, but I held her down." Police would later drive throughout Naperville with Hernandez, hoping he could identify the Nicarico home or the crime scene.
If we didn't run out of gas, we'd probably still be riding. We never found anything. He never could take us anyplace. He rode around and rode around looking at houses and places that he hoped would be it, I think. But he never could take us to that place.
Rolando. Orlando? Cruz?
Yeah.
Police. I'd ask you a couple questions.
I ain't do nothing.
Regardless, police followed the other leads Hernandez had given them.
Detective Cruzella, Detective
One led to a man named Rolando Cruz.
Name has come up in
Cruz was 19 years old, unemployed, and surviving on $75 a month in food stamps. He had been arrested on two occasions, once for trespassing, once for theft.
Alex Hernandez?
I know him, but I don't hang out with him, man.
Yeah? When was the last time you saw him?
They asked me about Alex. I told him that I knew what he looked like, his name, but I didn't know him specifically. I didn't hang around with him or anything like that.
Well, we have reason to suspect that Alex was involved in the Carrico murder?
Never heard of it.
So you don't know about the reward?
Well, I ain't don't know about no reward neither.
You hear about the reward?
I ain't hear about none neither. No.
Tempted by the reward money, both Rolando Cruz and Alex Hernandez began to feed police a series of tidbits on the murder of Janine Nicarico.
$10,000.
In the process, they implicated themselves.
The arrest and conviction of the offenders.
1 year passed from the date of Janine's death. There's no, the investigation was going nowhere. There was an election that was coming up. And I just believe that the police took whoever was convenient and whatever evidence, no matter how implausible it was, no matter how weak it was, and said, let's bring a criminal prosecution against these people.
On March 8, 1984, a grand jury indicted Hernandez, Cruz, and Steve Buckley on 36 counts, including murder, rape, and deviant sexual assault. Once the indictments were handed in, John Sam expected the defendants to roll on each other. To his surprise, it didn't happen.
It was kind of like the air was out of the balloon then. I mean, that was it. It was like we threw our last trump card, hoping that something was going to come from it, and it never did. It felt like right then and there, it's time to go on and find someone else. It kind of like, at that point, put it in my mind that these guys just weren't involved.
Despite resistance from his superiors, Sam continued investigating on his own. Finally, in December of 1984, 1 month before the three men went on trial, Sam handed in his resignation and cleaned out his desk.
Good luck, Sam.
See you, John.
The real killer was still out there, in my opinion, and we, the police, weren't looking for him. If we weren't looking for him, that meant nobody was looking for him. And therefore, he was still out there, and he could either kill again or he just gets away with it. And that, to me, was the worst part of this whole thing.
In January of 1985, Alex Hernandez and Rolando Cruz were convicted of Jeanine Nicarico's murder. Steve Buckley's trial ended in a hung jury, and the prosecution would eventually decide not to retry him. Alex Hernandez and Rolando Cruz were sentenced to die for the murder of 10-year-old Jeanine Nicarico. 6 months later, police found the body of 7-year-old Melissa Ackerman in a drainage ditch in Kane County, Illinois, right next to DuPage County. Like Jeanine, she had been abducted and raped. 5 days after Melissa was found dead, a man under arrest for 3 other sexual assaults was charged with her murder. His name was Brian Dugan. The arrest of Brian Dugan soon cast considerable doubt on the convictions of Rolando Cruz and Alex Hernandez. Dugan wanted to cut a deal, but refused to formally confess without guaranteed immunity from the death penalty. However, to his attorney, he admitted raping and killing 3 people: Melissa Ackerman, a 27-year-old nurse named Donna Schnorr, and Jeanine Nicarico.
How did you leave the body? In other words, like what position? All right.
Dugan refused to talk directly to the authorities. Commander Ed Sosowski of the Illinois State Police came up with a list of questions about the Nicarico case and gave them to Dugan's attorney.
Brian? How you doing? I got a couple of questions. What kind of a car were you driving on February 25th of 83?
In 83, I was driving a green Velari.
Green?
Yeah.
According to Dugan, on the day Jeanine Nicarico was murdered, he did not go to work. His employer confirmed his absence. Dugan said he prowled through Naperville, smoking marijuana. Sometime in the early afternoon, he knocked on the front door of the Nicarico home.
Hello, who is it?
I need to borrow a screwdriver.
Sorry. I'm not allowed to open the door for strangers. Try next door. Sorry.
Okay.
In point after point, Dugan's description matches the evidence. Dugan claimed that he bound and gagged Jeanine. He described the sheet in which he wrapped her and remembered he had taken time to wipe his fingerprints from the doorknob. He also said he was wearing the same brand of boots that matched the print found on the Nicarico door. Dugan described driving Jeanine to the Illinois Prairie Path. There he claimed he raped her, beat her with a tire iron, and left her. Dugan's story also matched the testimony of 2 tollway workers who had reported seeing a white man driving a green car on the day of the murder. Dugan remembered seeing the men and said that as he drove out of the park, he almost got stuck trying to turn around. His car had tires that were consistent with the tire prints left at the crime scene.
Where do you think he's going?
He said, I did it, and here is how I did it, and here are the details of what I did. And he said it in such a way as to permit the Illinois State Police to corroborate each and every of the 50 or so details he gave to Commander Sosowski and prove that he and he alone did the crime.
A polygraph test given by the Illinois State Police indicated that Dugan was telling the truth. Nevertheless, DuPage County prosecutors never charged him with Jeanine's murder and never offered him a plea bargain.
This case was like a runaway train in the sense that the prosecutors convicted 2 men and yet refused in light of overwhelming evidence which showed that they had made a mistake to admit that mistake.
Then in January of 1988, the Supreme Court ruled that Cruz and Hernandez should not have been tried together and ordered new separate trials for each.
All rise.
2 years later, on January 11th, 1990, Rolando Cruz went on trial for the second time. The defense intended to prove that Brian Dugan alone was responsible for Jeanine's murder. The prosecution, on the other hand, theorized that if Dugan had murdered Jeanine, Cruz and Hernandez were his accomplices.
Officer Wilkos, did you have occasion to participate?
They presented testimony from a police officer who said that Cruz's cousin, Irma Rodriguez, had told him she had seen Dugan and Cruz together.
To interview one
when Rodriguez took the stand, she denied it.
1989.
Yes, I did.
Commander Sosowski.
Without direct testimony from Dugan, the defense had to rely on what State Police Commander Sosowski had learned about Dugan's background and criminal M.O.
Would you tell the ladies and gentlemen of this jury what you learned about Brian Dugan's background?
The prosecution, however, objected.
I'm going to object unless we are talking.
And the judge did not allow the line of questioning.
Objection sustained. Commander.
It was utterly frustrating. The jury was not permitted to hear much of the statements made by Dugan confessing the crime of his sole and exclusive participation in the death of Jeanine Nicarico.
Mr. Stonehouse told you that as he processed the outside.
In summation, the prosecution argued that the footprints found outside the Nicarico home prove several people, not just Dugan, were involved with Jeanine's murder.
He found two different distinct shoe impressions.
They argued that because there were two footprints underneath a dining room window, and because there was a boot print on the front door, and because the boot print on the front door was different from the two footprints by the window, that therefore Dugan was a liar when he said he committed the crime alone. They said to our jury, there are three different sets of footprints. It must have been three different people involved in the crime.
Several months later, a crucial footprint evidence was found to be bogus. Two of the prints were, in fact, a woman's size 5.5 or 6, but the jury never heard this. The DuPage County prosecutors say that they were unaware of the discrepancy. The defense attorneys disagree.
The entire theory of the prosecution's case was that there were multiple intruders. In order to prove that there were multiple intruders, they had to show that there were footprints around the perimeter of the house that belonged to the two other people. And they knew that this wasn't a male's shoe, and they didn't tell us.
They knew that Rolando and Alex and Stephen Buckley couldn't have made those footprints, and they lied about it. Now, that's misconduct. And you shouldn't be afraid of the word prosecutorial misconduct. You should point your finger and say, you were wrong.
The jury finds the defendant, Rolando Cruz, guilty of the offense of aggravated kidnapping.
On February 1st, 1990, the jury returned its verdict.
The jury finds the defendant, Rolando Cruz, guilty of the offense of murder.
I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand how anybody could have said guilty again. My first reaction was to look back behind me where my mother and my sister were sitting and to make sure that they were okay. And, you know, that's my main concern is my family. So I looked back at them and I just thought as well, just gotta keep fighting these people. I mean, can't give up. And after all these years, you don't give up.
The jury finds the defendant, Alejandro Hernandez, guilty of
the second trial of Alex Hernandez ended in a hung jury. At his third trial, Hernandez was once again found guilty of murder and kidnapping. He was sentenced to 80 years in prison. His conviction and sentence are currently under appeal. Rolando Cruz remains on death row, awaiting execution.
How can you sit there and say, we're going to execute you, and though this other person confessed, we think he's lying personally, so we're not putting him on the stand? Well, it's not. My understanding is it's not for the state to decide whether I'm guilty. It's for the jury. So put Dugan on the stand and let the jury hear what Dugan's got to say. Let him either be totally discredited or let us prove he's telling the truth. And let the jury determine what the outcome is.
John Sam is not the only person to quit in protest over the handling of Jeanine Nicarico's murder investigation. Philip Gilman, director of the DuPage County Crime Lab, also left his job. In June of 1992, Assistant Attorney General Mary Bridget Kenney turned in her letter of resignation, saying, I have come to believe Rolando Cruz is not guilty. I do not want to be party to the execution of an innocent man. Rolando Cruz is scheduled to die by lethal injection in just over a month on March 22, 1993. Recently, we featured a story that began in Madisonville, Tennessee during the Great Depression.
Evening.
Evening.
In the spring of 1939, Tom Underwood, an out-of-work single father, left his two young daughters, Madeline and Ada, in the care of a kindly farmer named Charlie Best.
Times were hard, but he was willing to take them and give them a home and give them what we had to eat. It might not have been everything, but we never did go hungry.
Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Madeline and Ada were immediately accepted as part of the family. Charlie treated them as if they were his own children. Over the next 2 years, Tom Underwood visited his daughters on several occasions. Then in the spring of 1941, he returned to the farmhouse for the final time.
Ian? Mr. Underwood.
Zella, may I come for the children? It's coming on nightfall, and I need to be on the road before dark. If you'll just pack some things for me.
That afternoon, Tom Underwood left with his daughters. The Best family never saw Madeline or Ada again. At the time we filmed this story, Charlie Best was 96 years old. Although he had not seen Madeline or Ada in more than 50 years, they were never far from his thoughts.
Is it cold enough for you today? He don't look at them as being women. He calls them the little girls. Just the other day he said, have you heard any more about the little girls? And I said, no, Daddy, but they're coming. They're coming.
The night this story aired, Ada Underwood, now 59 years old, was watching our broadcast at her home in Indiana. Ada was shocked to see herself and her older sister Madeline profiled. Sadly, Madeline passed away several years ago. But for Ada, Charlie and Zella Mae's story stirred distant childhood memories. 10 days after our broadcast, Ada Underwood traveled to Madisonville, Tennessee for a very special reunion. Charlie Best and his two children, Zella Mae and Carl.
Well, I was anxious to see her. It was exciting to know she was coming.
Well, you still look like yourself.
No, I'm a lot older.
Glad you got to come.
It is. It's a day I have been waiting for really for 51 years.
Yeah. And how's your father?
Well,
I was very excited when I heard that they were looking for me because somebody cared enough about me to hunt for me that long.
Although only 8 years old when she last saw Charlie, Ada never forgot the warmth and kindness he and his family brought into her life.
Well, this year's Ada, Daddy, do you remember?
Charlie had to be very good to my sister and I for him to take us in and take care of us when we had nobody else to take care of us. And so I think he had to be a really great man.
You're pretty.
Thank you.
You're pretty.
You think you look like you used to?
It just meant a lot to Daddy. And I feel that in his own mind, dream has come true.
Sadly, 8 weeks after we filmed this update, Charlie Best passed away. According to his family, the reunion with Ada brought Charlie great comfort in his final days.
there. Come on, one more big push. Come on, one more. Come on.
February 4th, 1969.
It's a girl.
In Manitoba, Canada, Dorothy Meeches, a member of the Plains Ojibwe Indian Nation, gave birth to a daughter. She named the baby Priscilla, but Dorothy's joy would be all too brief. Even though she was unmarried and living with her parents, she already had five children.
You need to sign here.
Within days, a social worker convinced Dorothy to give up her new baby.
What I thought, me, when I was signing those papers, I thought they were going to place her in a home for a few months till I got back on my feet, get a place of my own so I can get her back. But all this time, those were adoption papers I was signing.
People were in difficulty, as in all communities, difficulties occur. And rather than rehabilitative work, any type of counseling, any type of resources being placed in those homes or in those communities, children were taken out.
You're doing the right thing, Dorothy. She'll be well taken care of.
2 decades ago, what happened to Dorothy Meeches was not uncommon on Indian reservations throughout Canada. Families torn apart by a well-meaning but misguided social welfare system. However, Dorothy and Priscilla were more fortunate than most. In 1987, they would be reunited through the Native Adoption Registry in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
I feel hurt sometimes because she wasn't raised up with us. I didn't see her since she was small. Like, it's nice to have her back with the family.
I am happy that I did this. I'm glad that I found my family. And if there are other children out there that are looking for their parents, I would advise them to do it, because it's something that they would like, if they'd like to know about their family, they may as well give it a chance, because their families are probably looking for them right now.
During the 1960s and 70s, thousands of Native American children were removed from their tribal homelands in Canada and placed with adoptive parents, many of them white, many of them in the United States. It was a system born of cultural misunderstanding, which has since proven to be a colossal mistake. This forced exodus of children has created a lost generation which can never fully be replaced. Perhaps someone in our audience will be able to fulfill two families' dreams of reunion.
For as much as it hath pleased Almighty God.
When her mother died in 1972, 14-year-old Glenda Keewaytin Kapo stood with her father at the funeral. Glenda had no way of knowing that she and her six brothers and sisters would soon become part of Canada's lost generation.
God have mercy on her soul.
Just hours after the funeral, a social worker arrived, unannounced, at their home.
Two younger children today. That's
Gail and Maureen.
Yeah, Gail and Maureen. And then I'll be back later in the week for the rest of the children, okay?
I think my father was in shock still. Because, like, when I look back now, I remember my dad, when you talk to him, like, he'd just say, just agreeing with everything.
He'd have come down to the office sometime to sign some more papers.
Okay? He was real quiet.
So, could you call over Maureen and Gail?
Gail, Maureen, come here.
Within a week, all seven children would be taken away. Maureen and Gail adopted, the oldest sister sent to relatives, Glenda and her three brothers placed in separate foster homes.
Are you taking me to Mommy?
I think my dad was really, really hurt. But I think at the time too, my dad felt like he was doing what was best. There's a lot of fear and not knowing, like, what was going to happen to the rest of us. And I guess somehow feeling like we weren't going to see each other again.
Fortunately, Glenda was wrong. Over the last few years, all the Keewaytin Kapo children have been reunited, except one. There is no existing photograph of Maureen Frances Keewaton Capel. She was born on June 29, 1968, and was adopted by a family in Brandon, Manitoba. Like many of Canada's lost generation, Maureen is the youngest in her family. Sadly, it seems the little ones are hardest to find. When Sandra Seton was just 9 years old, her family was broken apart. She is still searching for her two youngest brothers.
Hi, Dad. Where are you going? Mom!
Sandra's father was an alcoholic who often beat her mother. In 1969, he was barred from the house by court order. Sandra's mother was forced to take work as a food vendor with a traveling carnival.
Sandra, I have something to tell you.
What?
I'm going to be going away for a few weeks.
Why?
I'm just not making enough money looking after houses here.
Well, who's going to be watching us?
You see that lady over there?
Yeah.
Her name is Eleanor. She's my friend. She'll be looking after you.
When are you coming back home?
I'll be back in 3 weeks.
The babysitter stayed with us for a while, and then she left. And so it was just us kids that were home. We were very careful that, you know, we didn't want anybody to know we were alone. We were kind of waiting and hoping Mom would be back.
Hi. Is your mommy or daddy home? Have they been gone a long time?
Yes.
I'm Mary Williamson from the welfare department, and we've come to take you away to somewhere where someone can take care of you, all right?
It happened so fast. They just, you know, come in and they don't really explain anything. You know, they just picked up the kids and then put them in the car.
What about us?
We're coming back for you.
That was real scary, you know, not knowing where they were going to be taken. You kind of go a little dead inside or something, you know, because we're all just kids.
Your Honor, a representative of the Children's Aid Society arrived.
On October 25th, 1969, Sandra's mother was summoned before a Winnipeg court.
The director of the Children's Aid Society is petitioning the court at this time for custody of Mrs. Seton's 6 children.
I read the material. Are you the mother of Sandra, Wanda, Brenda, Chesley? Could you please stand?
A lot of our people showed up in court, but they were so intimidated by that whole process.
Yes,
that with a social worker sitting up there and giving evidence,
yes,
and saying how bad these people are. Most cases, the parents just kind of snuck out the back door and just went away because they were so intimidated by the whole process and they were so ashamed of what the social worker was saying about them.
Having reviewed the material, and there's no opposition by the mother, the order will go as applied for, and the children placed in the custody of the Director of Child Welfare.
We were sort of just in there and out of there again. And really, you know, not understanding too much. You know, I always prayed for my mom and my dad and wherever my brothers and sisters were, you know, every day, you know, hoping that we'd all get back together again and, you know, somehow make things work.
In 1971, Sandra was reunited with her two sisters, Wanda and Brenda. In 1988, they found their brother, Chesley, who'd been adopted in the United States. Along the way, they also found their mother, who was joined in the search for the two youngest boys, Calvin and Bernard.
It's very hard, because I think about them all the time in anything I do, and I pray for them every night that someday we'll all be a family again.
I believe that they're out there and they're wondering too, you know, about us. I just feel it, you know, and somewhere You know, I'm gonna find Calvin and Bernie. I think it's gonna be real soon, too.
On the night this story aired in Canada, Bernie's adoptive parents and one of Calvin's former foster mothers were watching the show. Through their efforts and cooperation, the two brothers were put in touch with their sister, Sandra. 3 weeks after our broadcast, everything was arranged. March 4th, 1993 would be a day of reunions, joy and tears. At 10:30 a.m., Sandra and her mother, Myrna, were at the Winnipeg airport awaiting the arrival of Bernie.
I had such an anxious feeling just looking and wondering, because we hadn't seen Bernie at all. We didn't see no picture, and then all of a sudden, his face just, you know, sort of just was right there, and I thought, oh, that's him. Oh, and then...
With Bernie back in the fold, the group headed to Myrna's house, where they knew Calvin would be waiting. In his youth, Calvin had been shunted about to 14 different foster families. Now he was finally home again after nearly 25 years.
Bernie.
Hey, you know, so little. It feels really good to be taken in instead of being pushed away. Hey, like, this is a big switch for me, and I'm happy. If I knew bigger words, I probably could say some big word that would describe how I feel right now, but there's no words that I can think of that describes this. Just, you know, it's the beginning. I just think it's the beginning of a good thing.
It's all good. It feels great. Just great that there's a piece of my life put together, which I think all my friends knew that there was a piece missing. Maybe this is just the part to my life that was missing.
Got so much to talk about, you know? So much. It's just a really great feeling. There is a piece, you know? There was always that piece of my heart somehow just needed, you know, to know that they were okay.
Yeah, tonight.
Each one of us has our own lives, but it's so good to know that we have family.
On May 20th, 1991, the Henderson family of Washburn, Texas, gathered to bid farewell to one of its members. 66-year-old Bill Henderson, a retired banker, had been plagued by heart and lung problems for years. But the grief his family felt was compounded by anguish and anger. For Bill Henderson had not succumbed to illness. He had been murdered in his own bedroom.
I'm mad about what happened to my dad. I feel like he was cheated. I felt like my whole family was cheated. And it was very brutal.
Freezer, and that'll take care of you till Saturday when I see you again, okay?
I'll be fine.
On May 12, 1991, Bill Henderson said goodbye to his wife, granddaughter, and great-granddaughter.
I love you.
I love you too.
They were off to visit relatives in Austin, Texas, more than 400 miles away. Bill's failing health prevented him from leaving home for long periods. Over the next 3 days, Bill stayed in touch with other family members. Then, for an entire day, no one heard from him. Finally, on May 16th, Bill's son, Gary, tried to reach him by phone.
Started calling my dad about 1 o'clock, I guess. And Every time I called, it was just a busy signal, so I didn't really know if the phones were just off the hook or what happened.
We was afraid that maybe he may have had a heart attack or some health problem and was sick in the house and couldn't get to the telephone, or maybe had been trying to call for help and dropped the telephone or something like that. That's what we was afraid of.
Concerned, Gary, Frank, and Frank's stepdaughter, Sherry, went to Bill's house to investigate.
His truck's not out front. I don't know where he is.
Their concern turned to alarm when they noticed that Bill's pickup truck was gone.
Dad?
When we arrived at my dad's house, the phone in the kitchen was off the hook. My brother-in-law, Frank, went over and hung that phone up, and then I decided to go on through the house and check the other phone. So I was walking down the hall, saw my dad's glasses, broken glasses, laying in the floor. Really, I still didn't think a whole lot about it until we got on down the hall and there was a picture laying in the floor. And that's when I saw my father laying in the floor and my room all tore up.
Frank!
Frank come into the room and he fell to my dad, and my dad had been, he was cold. He'd been there for a while, and I remember telling Frank that I think it's too late or something like that, and Frank told me that he didn't think my dad died of a heart attack, that it looked like he was murdered.
Bill Henderson had been strangled and beaten to death with an electric iron a full 8 to 10 hours before he was found.
This was an extremely violent murder. The man was beaten time and time again, and it was extremely obvious to us also that Mr. Henderson had put up a fight for his life.
Police were puzzled by the lack of an apparent motive for such a brutal killing. The only item missing, other than Bill's pickup truck, was his wallet. Then, 5 days later, a man walking along Interstate 40, 90 miles east of Amarillo, made a curious discovery. Bill Henderson's wallet. The next day, Bill Henderson's pickup truck was discovered, abandoned, just outside of Chicago, Illinois, more than 1,000 miles from Amarillo. Police searched the vehicle, but found no clues which would lead them to a suspect. But they did learn of two eyewitnesses who not only saw the killer, but actually spent the day with him riding in Bill Henderson's truck. On the day of the murder, some 265 miles east of Washburn, three young men arrived at a truck stop near Oklahoma City. It was immediately obvious that something was not quite right.
The truck stop attendant told us that he had two young men come into the truck stop, and they were extremely nervous.
Excuse me, you gotta do something. That guy stole a pickup truck.
What?
That guy picked us up.
Started telling him that the truck they were in that the man had stolen.
What pickup truck?
Out there, the brown one.
You gotta do something.
The two hitchhikers start requesting that he call the police department.
8861, Texas.
The driver of the truck used the telephone, then went to the restroom. The truck stop attendant took the opportunity to call the police.
Yeah. It's not reported stolen. Okay, thanks.
He got the license number off the truck. He called it in to the local authorities. They run it and called him back.
They said it's not stolen.
It's got to be stolen.
They said no.
The problem we had was that when they ran the license plate number on the truck, we had yet to find Mr. Henderson's body.
15 minutes later, the driver of the pickup truck left. The hitchhikers refused to accompany him any further.
After the suspect drove off, they were still so insistent on trying to get this man picked up, so scared of him, that they went and dialed 911 themselves, trying to get someone to stop the suspect in the truck.
Yeah, I'd like to report a stolen vehicle.
Again, sheriff's deputies maintained that no such vehicle had been reported missing. According to the attendant, the two hitchhikers then headed towards the highway. They never gave authorities their names or addresses. Unhampered in his flight, the suspect continued north along Interstate 287. According to police calculations, he would have required at least one stop for refueling before reaching Hazel Crest, Illinois, where he abandoned the pickup truck less than 24 hours later.
I think it's extremely important that we catch this man. Anybody that will attack an elderly man that is nearly defenseless because of natural disease and illnesses will attack and kill anybody.
He restores my soul. He leads me in the path. It hurts to know what Bill had to go through, the pain and suffering he had to go through out there before he took his last breath. And I would just like to see this person caught and tried, convicted, and sentenced.
I don't feel like my dad should have had to see something like that leaning over him, you know, as the last thing he ever saw. It just wasn't fair.
Who murdered Bill Henderson? Police have but one solitary clue that may ultimately give them an answer.
There was a palm print in blood inside the room. It was on a art-type tablet. If we can find the person that matches up to that bloody palm print, then we have our murder suspect. Tomorrow night on Unsolved Mysteries. Shortly after the death of his grandfather, Donnie Decker's friends and family noticed a change had come over him and his surroundings. Rain appeared everywhere, and no one, not even the police, could find its source. But that was only the beginning. San Francisco, the city of shimmering lights. But on February 24th, 1992, across the bay, a bizarre, senseless death. Miraculously, Michael Hunter managed to guide his motorcycle into a gas station despite being shot through the heart. Moments later, he was dead, and police would like your help to catch his killer. Join me tomorrow night. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. Thank you.